Hey, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to our 3 Days in 30 Minutes, a special Monday night edition of our Shir. I want to thank our very generous sponsors. First of all, our dear friend Howard Stricker. Howard, raise your hand. New to the community from the 11559. Howard is sponsoring in honor of our Shir in the beautiful and inspiring Divrei Torah. We are very grateful, Howard, for your sponsorship and for being a part of our community. And I hope everyone will go over and introduce themselves to Howard afterwards. And to our very generous sponsors, Dr. Michael and Marilyn Fedak, in gratitude for the many weekly learning opportunities at BRS. And as always, our learning should be in Aliyah from the Neshama of Esther Tehila Bas Gabriel Pinchas, whose Yurtzeit is coming up this Shabbos, which means this Parsha takes on extra meaning as well. For our hot dog of the week, we go with Jesse. Jesse, my new friend, who's setting a record for the youngest hot dog eater at our shir. So Jesse, enjoy, go back for seconds, thirds, but don't get a bellyache along the way. And if you do, blame your dad, not me. All right, here we go. Idea number one, for those who learn Daf Yomi, comes from the Gemara in Zvachim. Of course, we know at the beginning of the Parsha is one of the most famous Rashis, I think, in all of Torah. Gotta be top five Rashis. And that is Vayishma Yisro. So Rashi says, Mashmua Shamova. What is it that Yisro heard? So you heard about Kriyas Yam Suf and Milchemes Amalek. The truth is, if you look at the Gemara has a little bit of a different version, which we're going to read right now. And that is on page number one, which is not numbered, but hopefully you can all hack page number one. Page number one says, Ketanai, that there's a Machlokas Tanayim. What did Yisro hear about? So Rav Yehoshua comes along and he says he heard about Milchemes Amalek. And then Rav Elezer HaModai, in the second paragraph, comes along. And he says he heard about Matan Torah. Yisro heard about Matan Torah. Now, of course, we have to figure out, you know, the order of how the Pesukim happened. That's a whole sugya in and of itself, which we're not going to delve into right now. But Rav Elezer Madai says he heard about Matan Torah. So what did he hear about? So listen to this Gemara. Now, those who learned Daf Yomi, my guess is you flew through the Gemara and didn't really think about that, like I did. But when you stop to think about the Gemara, it's a very strange Gemara. Says the Gemara, Keshenitna Torah LeYisrael Hayakola Holech Misofa Olam Ve'ad Sofo. That when the Torah was given, there was this voice that went out from one end of the world to the other. That's Vayishma Yisro. Yisro heard that this voice went out. So what happened, the Gemara says, when this voice went out? V'chol Malchei Umos Olam Achazasam Ra'ada Be'ichleim Va'amru Shira. So they all start panicking. They all start shaking. So what do they do? Because they don't know what this voice is, right? Can you imagine if all of a sudden you heard this like thunderous noise and you didn't know what that meant? So Niskab Sukula Meitzel Bilam Arasha. So all of them run to Bilam. After all, we know Bilam is a prophet. He's a Navi. So they all want to know, what is this sound that we're hearing? Amrulo, they say to Bilam, Ma Kola Hamon Asher Shamanu. What is this sound? Shema Mabul Bala Olam. Maybe Hashem is about to create another flood. Again, this wasn't just any other sound. This was shaking and thunderous. And so they all start panicking. They run to Bilam. They say, what's this sound? Maybe Hashem is recreating a flood. Amar Lahem, Bilam says, you don't have anything to worry about because Hashem already promised that he would never bring a flood back to the world. So they said, okay, if that's the case, if it's not a flood, Uma Kol HaAmon HaZeh Sheshamanu, in the last paragraph, then what is this sound that we're hearing? Amar Lahem, Bilam says back to them, you're hearing something entirely different. Not something scary, but something beautiful. Chem de tova yesh lo bebeis gnazav, that Hashem has been keeping something in his treasury. Shaisa genuza etzlo chameos shimim ve'arba doros, that's been held in his treasury for 974 generations, right, from the time he created the world. Ubikesh litna levanav, and now Hashem is going to give that Torah to his people. So says the Gemara, that's Vayishma Yisro. What did Yisro hear? Yisro heard this sound that caused everyone to panic. They didn't know what it was. They run to Bilam and they say, Bilam, maybe it's a Mabul. He says, no, it's not a Mabul. Rather, it's Hashem giving the Torah. That's the Gemara. Ask for Meir Shapiro a very simple question on the Gemara, which I think should bother all of you. What was the Havamina of the Umos Olam? In other words, what was their thought process? Why did they mistake Matan Torah for a Mabul? When they heard this thunderous sound, why did their mind immediately go to Hashem must be coming to destroy the world? In Gemara terms, we would say, what's the Havamina? What was their thought? Why did they think that in the first place? That's where Meir Shapiro asked the question. And I'd like to build upon what he answers and develop into a very beautiful thought. Says Meir Shapiro, what the Umos Olam, what the nations of the world were confused by, is they saw the Jewish people at the Yam, at Kriyas, at Kabbalah Satorah. They saw that we were all Kishe Echad B'Lev Echad. They saw the unity of the Jewish people, and they made the following assumption. If the Jewish people are unified, it must be that something bad is about to happen. Because the only time we express unity is when bad things happen. So if you paid attention to many rabbis' sermons on Yom Kippur right before October 7th, they all spoke about what's going on in Israel, and about how horrible it is, and about how he's tearing apart the country, and about it's the Haredim versus the Chilonim. Right, that's all the denominations, that's what they were speaking about. Just a few days later, October 7th, what happened? All of a sudden, 15 days later, we couldn't get our act together. We were fighting with one another. They were predicting a civil war. All of a sudden, we get along. Unprecedented unity amongst the Jewish people. What changed? Changed was a tragedy. All of a sudden, a tragedy happens. We put aside all the differences. We learn to get along. So the nations of the world see that the Jewish people are unified and united, and they assume something bad must be about to happen. Because the only time Jews get along is when there's a tragedy, or when there's a gun to our head, or when someone wants to destroy us. We're about to come to the story of Purim. All of a sudden, Purim's happening. Haman says, I want to kill the entire Jewish people. What does Esther say to the Jewish people? What's her one advice to the Jewish people? Lech, Kenosis Kol HaYehudim. Go gather the entire Jewish people. Vitsumo Alai, and fast for me for 3 days. Now they're unified. They weren't unified beforehand. Yeah, that's the exact point. Is that when we're not being threatened by an enemy, then all the differences. Then we're fighting. Then there's almost a civil war. But the second there's a gun to our head, the second Haman wants to kill us, the second Hamas attacks, all of a sudden that all disappears and we get along well together. And then the second that dissipates and the threat is no longer there, what happens? We go right back to our infighting. But the nations of the world see that the Jewish people are unified. They say there must be something bad's going to happen. And what does Bilam come back to them? Bilam comes back to them and says, no. This is something different altogether. This is a different kind of unity. A unity that's not born out of people wanting to kill us, but a unity born out of a unified mission and a unified purpose. And that sense of unity is much more long-lasting. That sense of unity is much more enduring. Because as I showed all the examples, the Holocaust, October 7th, I can tell you all the examples. Yes, we unified when something bad happened, but immediately after the threat disappeared, we went back to our divisiveness. We went back to our disagreements. We went back to our fighting. Bilam comes along and says this unity is different because a unity that's formed not out of a threat, but out of a common purpose and a shared set of values, that is a unity that has the potential to be everlasting. And says Rav Meir Shapiro, now you understand the entire conversation that's taking place here. The nations of the world hear this thunderous thing. They see the unity of the Jewish people. They say there must be something bad's going to happen. Bilam comes along and says, no, Hashem's about to give his Torah. And the Jewish people are about to be unified by something much deeper and much more everlasting than just any threat. And that is a shared sense of values and purpose. And that ultimately, I think, is what's been missing from the conversation of the last 3 years and what you and I have to get back to. You and I have to realize that of all the people in the room right now, what unifies is not just that if they send us back to the gas chambers, we're all going to be sent in together. That's not just what unifies us. What unifies us is not that when the Cossacks or the Nazis or Hamas or whatever example you want to give, that when they come barreling down the street with their pitchforks and their bonfires, and they're coming for us, they're not going to differentiate whether you're wearing a kippah or not wearing a kippah, whether it's velvet or knit. They're not going to care about anything. They can see you're a Jew. That there has to be something more that unifies us. And what unifies us is the fact that you and I are sitting around a table and we're learning Torah. The fact that unifies us, that we have a shared, not just fate, but we have a shared destiny. And that applies to whether you're a secular Jew or a religious Jew. That applies to wearing your kippah, not wearing a kippah, whether your tzitzit is not wearing a tzitzit, what type of yarmulke or what type of hat you're wearing. It doesn't matter. We are bound by a common destiny. And the more we learn to share that language with each other, not just that we were persecuted together, but that we have a common destiny together, that is a unity that can be much more meaningful and everlasting. Because when I look at you, I don't just see someone that I'm going to be persecuted with, but I see someone that has a chelak eloka mimal, someone that has a sense of godliness in them, that both you and I were created in the image of Hashem, that both you and I have the light of Hashem. And therefore, that's what binds me to you. And if we can develop a unity that's based on that, it's much more everlasting and it's much harder to break. You know, for those who we were joking around, I'm going to London this week. So I'm going to London. I spoke about it last week for this very special Jew that I met in Memphis and that Baruch Hashem I've been in touch with very closely since. And one of the things, he sent me a beautiful message the other day, and he and I speak about it a lot. What makes it amazing about the relationship, and this is what I love so much, he and I couldn't be more different. Hashkafically, politically, religiously, right? So different. He's a Samar Chassid, I went to YU. We're so different. But what allowed us to connect with each other was that we had a shared language. It wasn't just, oh, our daughters are both in St. Jude together. We had a shared language, and we shared Divrei Torah together, and he read the Megillah for my family, and they went to the Purim Suda. In other words, like it wasn't just like, oh, we're in a bad situation together, but that you're a Jew and I'm a Jew, and therefore there's something that binds us that's really deep. And once you develop a connection based on that, it is unbreakable, and it is everlasting. And so I would encourage all of us not just to focus on Jews as we're persecuted together, and therefore we have to learn to get along together. That was the unity of post-October 7th. But as we see right now, it's short-lived. We have to develop a much deeper unity one to another, where we understand that there's a common destiny that we share with each other. That is, says R' Meir Shapiro, the Vayishma Yisro. What did Yisro hear? He heard about Matan Torah, and he couldn't figure out what this unity is. Ah, it's a new type of unity. It's not a unity that's born out of suffering, but it's a unity that's born out of a shared destiny, and that is something that I think all of us can certainly work on. That is idea number one from R' Meir Shapiro. Idea number two, from the Oitzer Ephraim. I saw this quote, I thought that was such a beautiful idea. So of course we know that Moshe Rabbeinu comes to Yisro, and he says, something's not working. He says, I can't hack it all together. Right, Yisro hears. Then Yisro starts giving advice. Right before that, there's a pasuk. And the pasuk says, Vayikach Yisro Chosein Moshe Ola Uzvachim Lelokim. So Yisro, he starts offering sacrifices. Right, this is after he hears all the good news. Vayavo Aaron v'chol zikne Yisrael lechol lechem im Chosein Moshe lifnei Elokim. And Aaron and all the elders, so they come and they eat. Asks Rashi, who's missing from this story? Right, Yisro's there. Aaron's there, the Zikne Yisrael's there. Who didn't get invited to the party? Hooper Humperdinck. No one gets that reference. No, nobody. Okay, you're missing a good book, right? Hooper Humperdinck doesn't get invited to the party. Anyways, Moshe's not at the party. Rashi says. So Rashi asks, if I had my reading glasses, I could actually read it. Umoshe and Heichan Halach. Where is Moshe? So he says, Elashaya Omed Umishamish Lifnehem. Says Rashi. Rashi says, you want to know where Moshe was? Moshe was the server.
Waiter.
Right, the waiter. That there was a... West, maybe. Oh, no, I'm good. Thank you. That's why I practice in advance. But if I need it later, I'll... Thank you. I got to learn to carry them on me. But that's like giving in to the fact that I need reading glasses. I'm still going to like bluff my way away. And I could just hold paper like this, so I'm okay for now. Right? So you can imagine the scene. Aaron's there, and the Zakenim are there, and Yisro's there, and the entourage is there, and who's the waiter? Who's serving the hot dogs that night? Not Moshe Kamenetsky, but Moshe Rabbeinu. So what's going on here? So he asks here the following question on Rashi. Rashi says, Shaya Omed Umishamish Lifneim, that he was standing and waiting over them. If I told you that someone was waiting on you, mm-hmm. Do I have to tell you that they're standing there? Right? The implication is that if someone is waiting, I don't really care what they're doing. Maybe they're standing there. Maybe they're walking back from the kitchen. Why does Rashi need to add in the word that he is omed? So he says the following beautiful idea. I'll say it to you outside and then I'll read it inside. Moshe Rabbeinu at that moment could have been doing a whole slew of things. Moshe Rabbeinu could have been learning. Moshe Rabbeinu could have been davening. Right? Picture the most pious, righteous person you know in the world. Whatever image pops into your mind, that is what Moshe Rabbeinu could have been doing right now. He could have been learning Kabbalah. He could have been having a kumzitz. He could have been learning a tzais and a gemara. He could have been doing anything. What's Moshe Rabbeinu doing there? He's standing there waiting over people. Now, the imagery of standing, right? When we talk about someone who's standing still in life, is that a good connotation or a pejorative connotation? It's a pejorative connotation. We always talk about someone has to be on the move, growth mindset, that we're always growing and we're ambitious and we're always trying to learn. If I say someone is standing still, that's a negative connotation. That means that they're stagnant. That means that they're not pushing themselves. They're not growing. Says the Otzer Ephraim, that is the imagery of Moshe Rabbeinu right now. Moshe Rabbeinu could have been doing anything in the world. He could have been learning. He could have been davening. He could have been having a kumzitz. And you know what he's doing? Instead of advancing his own avodas Hashem, instead of growing on his own, you know what he chose to do? He chose to stand still, suppress his own spiritual growth. Why? For achnasas orchim. And that is the imagery that the Torah wants to communicate. Because the Torah says, according to the Otzer Ephraim, all of us were so consumed with wanting to grow. I have to grow, I have to improve, I have to be better, I have to die. Sometimes what the Torah wants from you is not to enhance your own spiritual growth, but rather to take care of other people. And even if that means you're going to sacrifice your own growth as a person, it's worth it because that's what Hashem wants from you. I'll give you the easiest example. The easiest example is as a parent, right? Arguably, if a person didn't get married or have children, it could be easier to grow spiritually. You'd have more time for learning. You'd have more time for davening, right? Think about how many times, in my life where I've had to not do things because my family needed me. But would I trade that spiritually because I could learn more Gemara, daven more? No, the answer is that there are different parts of my religious experience. And there are times where I suppress that spiritual growth and I say, you know what, I'm not going to do a certain thing because I have to take care of another person. Says the Otzer Ephraim, that is what the Torah wants us to understand here. That Moshe Rabbeinu could have been in shul. He could have been learning. He could have been. And instead, you know what he decides to do? He does another mitzvah. He does achnasas orchim. Sometimes what the Torah demands of us is just to be a nice person and to treat people nicely. And even if it means you might be a little late to something or you might not be able to do something else, that's okay every now and then. He says as a proof, he says, this is what it means, Vayered Moshe Minahar El Ha'am. When Moshe Rabbeinu comes down from our Sinai, the Pasuk says that he comes down from the mountain to the people. And the Rashi over there says, Milamed Shelo Haya Moshe Pone La'askav El Minahar El Ha'am. Moshe Rabbeinu comes down from the mountain. What does he run towards? So he could have run toward anything. Instead of doing his own needs, he runs to the people. He asks, what were Moshe's needs at the time? What Moshe needed to chop a game of golf at Adios? What was Moshe doing at the time? So he says, Moshe Rabbeinu, what it meant is Moshe Rabbeinu could have taken care of himself. He could have learned. He could have davened. He could have been advancing his own service of Hashem. And you know what he does instead? He turns to the people. He says, before I'm going to worry about me, I want to worry about you. I want to make sure you guys are okay. I want to take care of you. And I think that's such an important Musar Haskel, such an important lesson. Because we get so caught up sometimes in a very narrow definition of what it means to serve Hashem. Very narrowly serving Hashem, and again, it's important, and I'm not minimizing it at all, chas v'shalom. And you have to learn, and you have to daven, and you have to do all those things. But you can't do that at the expense of how you treat people. You can't do that at the expense of achnasas orchim. You can't do that at the expense of how you interact with people. Can't do that at the expense of how you smile at someone or how you hold the door for someone. If you run into shul, and because you're late or whatever, you look past someone, don't hold the door for someone, knock someone over, then you miss the whole point, says the Otzer Ephraim. Because part of our religious experience is not just for me and me and me, but it's to make sure that I'm taking care of you, 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 you. And that is part and parcel of what our job is. And therefore, he says, that's what it means that Moshe Rabbeinu is omed. Moshe Rabbeinu, instead of holech, instead of increasing his own service of Hashem, he omed. He says, you know what? I'm going to stop what I'm doing right now because there's a Jew who needs me. I'm going to stop what I'm doing right now because I have guests at the door. And even if that means I'm not going to be able to do something else, it's okay. Think about the greatest gedolim. I'm not going to tell stories now, but think about the greatest gedolim that we know. The greatest gedolim that we know are also the most sensitive, thoughtful people who, when you're with them, there's not a care in the world to them. And you could be asking them the stupidest, most trivial, mundane question. And when you're with them, they make you feel like there's nothing else in the world. Now, you know that they have questions to get back to. You know that they have shirim to prepare. You know they have all those things to do. But when you're with them, there's not a care in the world. I will share this, because he's going to be here the Shabbos, my Rebbe, Rabbi Neuberger. I could tell you that one of the most meaningful experiences, when I'm with him, I know how many questions he has to respond to. I know how many text messages, calls, and emails are waiting for him. I know how many shirim he has to prepare the next day. I know that I'm not even a congregant of his. I'm just a visitor. He's got hundreds and hundreds of people of his shul. But when I'm with him, there's nobody else in the world. My issue is the most important issue to him, even though it might be, in the grand scheme of things, trivial, but he recognized that it's important to me, and he gives me his full attention. Rabbi Kalish, who was here this Shabbos, same thing. It was amazing to me. People would stop him in the hallways, complete strangers. But when they asked him a question, now I knew he had to give three more drushas, and I was like yanking him away. But when he was locked into a conversation with someone, when someone needed his attention, that was the only thing that mattered. Not getting to Musaf, not giving the drush, or not. A Jew needs me, and that's where I'm going to be. That was Moshe Rabbeinu at this moment in time. Moshe Rabbeinu could have been doing a million other things for himself, but he puts it all aside and he says, a Jew needs me. I'm going to put all that aside. I'm going to be omed. I'm going to be present, and I'm going to care about the person in front of me. I'll be honest with you, and this is what we spoke to Rabbi Kalish about, both in our interview and behind the bima, and personally, it's hard for me. I have a natural clock in my head. It's an annoying clock that nags at me 24/7. It's part of, I don't know, maybe in another life I'm a yeki, I don't know. But I have a clock in my head, and it allows me to be places on time. It allows me to get back to people in a timely fashion. But it's a nagging clock in my head, which means that I'm always have the temptation when I'm in one place, I'm always thinking about where I have to go next. Okay, I'm here now, but I also know that at 7 o'clock I have this meeting, and at 8 o'clock I have that meeting. And like subconsciously in the back of my head, that's like nagging at me. I have to work on that. I always have to work on that, because it means that when I'm with someone else, I have to suppress that internal clock and say, I don't really care what's next. When I'm with you, I'm 100% with you. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu was able to do. Moshe Rabbeinu was omed. He was completely present. He was standing still. He wasn't worried about what else he has to do and what else he can be doing. But these Jews needed him, and he was there. And he was fully in, and he was present. And I think that's a lesson that all of us can take away from Moshe Rabbeinu being omed, by standing still. We're always on the run. Sometimes we have to learn to stand still, especially when another Jew needs us. Idea number three comes from Rabbi Y.Y. Jacobs. And this is a beautiful idea. It gets lost at the end of the Parsha. So, of course, we know that this Parsha has the most seminal moment in Jewish history. That was Kabbalas HaTorah, the receiving the Torah. And then tucked away at the end of the Parsha, most people here, our adventurers, say, didn't even know the Pasuk exists in the Parsha. But at the end of the Parsha, the Torah tells us about the Mizbeach, Velos Aleh B'malos Al Mizbachi, that you should not ascend the Mizbeach in steps, Asher Lo Segaler V'Schalav, so you should not reveal your nakedness onto it. And this is the halacha that to the Mizbeach we know it's a ramp and that it's not stairs. Says Rashi, what are we talking about here? What's the relationship between a ramp and not uncovering your nakedness? What is going on here? So Rashi says, Hamalos, that when you go upstairs, Atatzarich laharchib siascha. Right? Think about like, you know, high stairs. So you have to like take bigger steps. Whereas if you go up a ramp, you could kind of shuffle a little bit and you go a little slower. So you're not taking these big steps. And Rashi says that when you take big steps, what happens? So again, they didn't wear pants. If you picture like your old Scottish friend, don't picture that too much. But when you take big steps upstairs and you're wearing the robe that the Kohanim wore, so it wasn't the most sneeze thing. So therefore he says, don't take big steps, go up a ramp, take small steps. What is going on here, says Rabbi Y.Y. Jacobson. The most obvious question. If I told you that we have the story of giving the Torah, the most beautiful parsha in the world, right? We all stand for it, and the Baal Kore reads it in a different tune. It's amazing, and it's mesmerizing. We're supposed to feel it as if it happened again. If you were going to end that parsha, if I gave you like a million ways to end the parsha, my guess is none of you would have chosen, don't go upstairs to the Mizbeach, but go up a ramp because we don't want to uncover your nakedness. You know what that's like? It's like a crash landing after like, you know, shooting off with great fanfare. What is going on here? That's what he asks at the bottom of page one. Why is that the climactic moment of this parsha? What is the Torah trying to teach us? Look at the back page. This is one of those like life-changing ideas. I really believe that. Says Rav Yoyai, I'll read his words. Now, this idea is found in Rav Zevin's Sefer, La Torah V'Lamoadim, and I could have also tried to impress you by quoting you from Rav Zevin, but then I would have lost you. So instead, I'm quoting it from Rav Yoyai because he does such a beautiful job of describing it. He says, it is precisely in these final words that the Torah shares with us a moving lesson. Oh no, that's too much. Regarding the human quest to ascend God's altar, to climb the ladder of moral and spiritual enlightenment. No, that's also too much. Often in life, people experience a new awareness that inspires them to move their lives in a different level, to live deeper or to love deeper. They are moved to make changes, right? Sometimes you and I are inspired. We might be inspired when we meet another Jew. We might be inspired by the Siyama Shas and we see everyone finishing Shas. We might be inspired by the way someone davens and we say, you know what? I have to change something about my life. Maybe you're going to listen to Rabbi Goldberg's Shabbos HaGadol Drush or Shabbos Shuvah Drush and you're like, you know what? I have to change. And you're inspired to do that. So what happens when we do that though? Yet sometimes a result of a genuine longing to abandon a previous lifestyle of shallowness, falsehood, addiction, promiscuity, loneliness, or shame, people begin to take wide and expansive steps, determined to reach great peaks in short spans of time, craving to master elevated modes of consciousness and lifestyles. What happens is you come, you're so on fire from a Rabbi Goldberg Shabbos Shuvah Drasha, you know what you want to do? You want to change overnight. You want to take big, grandiose steps to change overnight. What happens when you do that? Thus, immediately following the most spiritually enlightening and earth-shattering event in history, when Hashem revealed himself, the Torah says, don't take big steps. Rather, you go up a ramp where you climb incrementally and you climb slowly. Says Rav Yoyai, do not become who you are not. Do not jump to places beyond yourself. Every movement forward must be internalized, integrated into your individual identity, because when you take steps that overwhelm you rather than elevate you, you may end up naked and exposed. I love that. You might fall down fast and hard. People who overestimate themselves often end up underestimating themselves. If you stretch too far, if you push yourself out beyond what you're capable of, you know what you do? You crash land. And all of us know people like this. Maybe it's happened in your life. Maybe it's happened you met a Baal Tshuva or a convert, someone who has just had this electric growth. And then what happens when they rise too fast and they become someone that they're not? They crash. They crash. When you grow too fast, when you become someone that you're not. So it's unhealthy. It's unhealthy. Oftentimes as rabbis, ironically, we, and our job is to slow people down and to say, whoa, 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 whoa. I know you want to become everything overnight. And I know you want to grow the beard and put on the hat and just slow down a little bit. Like, let's work on one thing at a time. Let's work on incremental steps. Because if you grow too fast, think about a stock, by the way. If a stock's going like that too fast, you know what's about to happen? It crash lands. You don't want to, you want to invest in that stock if you get a good tip at the bottom. But if it's at the top, you know it's coming crashing down. You want the stock that incrementally grows in a healthy way that you know it's sustainable. And so, yeah.
So I've been away from Judaism for around 50 years, 5-0, and about 5 or 6 years ago I returned. And so I'm in the synagogue every day. I put the film in Shabbat every day. But recently I started saying the Katamazon by myself. And I've been doing that for about 2 weeks. So the rabbi is saying, for me, it's all personal to me, because if I try to do too much...
Nah, you can't do too much. And don't try to become someone else. You got to stay true to you and grow slowly. And that's the way to do it. I think you're a hero because you're growing slowly. I think that's beautiful. And you keep growing. And you keep... Think about the ramp. You take small steps, but where do you get to by the end? You get to the destination. And so says Rav Yoyai. Thank you for sharing that. That was very meaningful. Never disregard the Torah's teaching us the value of one small move in the quest of truth. Saying Birchat HaMazon. Wherever you are in life, you can serve Hashem genuinely according to your own potential and situation. You can discover the light of Hashem within your present condition. Challenge yourself to encounter your own inner light and truth. You need not climb on the truth and experience of others. Grow, you must. Challenge yourself, you must. But take the ramp, not the stairs. Don't jump out of yourself, because your authentic self might be left behind. And when you discover that, you will fall down and lose everything you might end up bare. That is unbelievable. I really think this is like a top 5 idea. Says Rabbi Yoyai, This is the most fitting end to the story of Kabbalah Satorah, because as Hashem gives us the Torah, He says you're going to be so inspired and you're going to want so badly to conquer everything overnight. But He says if you try to conquer everything overnight, you're going to come crashing down. And so instead, don't take the steps, which are big. Take the ramp, or you could take small incremental steps. Every single one of us in our own life, when you bite off too much, you end up choking. As He says, the beautiful words, you're going to expose, you're going to end up naked and exposed. You're going to end up with nothing. And so in our own service of Hashem, each at our own level, stay true to yourself. Grow slowly. Take one small step at a time. Don't underestimate those small steps, because if you do one step at a time and you grow in a healthy fashion, then you'll reach the top of the mountain. If you try to jump, you're just going to, white man can't jump, you're just going to fall right down and crash to the floor. So we saw three ideas in 30 minutes. Idea number one from Meir Shapiro about what unity is, what false unity is, and what real unity is. False unity is just saying they wanted to kill us so it's get unified. That's short-lived. We have to recognize what real unity is, that each of us shares something much deeper and much more real, and that is something that is everlasting. Idea number two came from the Otzar Ephraim. We're always running in life. We're always running. We want to grow and improve and be ambitious. But sometimes you got to stand still and take care of other people and care about other people. And even if it means you're not going to advance your own personal growth in that minute, but that's what Hashem wants from you. Don't always be running. Sometimes, like Moshe Rabbeinu, we have to be omed. We have to be standing still. And idea number three, Rabbi Y.Y. Jacobson, I think this is a top five idea about taking the ramp, not the stairs. If you take the stairs, you walk too fast. And if you go too fast, you crash down and you burn. Rather, you got to take the ramp. Small, incremental steps where you stay true to yourself and to who you are and to what your potential is, and never underestimate the value of one small move for the quest of truth. And if you do that, then you will end up at the top of the mountain. And if you don't, you're going to crash down. And with all that, I wish everyone a beautiful Shabbos.